Remember to celebrate milestones as you prepare for the road ahead. This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
And it's great to join all of you here again. And interestingly, Marcus and I can actually truly say this time that we are joining you from the studio at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus, this feels kind of strange.
This is quite bizarre. It's been over a year and a half since we've actually recorded physically in a studio. And now the studio here has been renovated, so I'm having to reacclimate to what is a very snazzy looking environment.
It does. It feels really good to be sitting across the table from my brother, rather than looking at him on the screen. We have turned our for the past 2.5 years, I guess, Marcus. We turned our offices, our own offices at our homes, into the studio for the show. But it feels really interesting, and it feels really good to be here in the studio. And we're celebrating a milestone. This is the 100th show of the Waters and Harvey Show. I've got to ask you, Marcus, how does that feel to you?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. And I have to back up for a moment and say that now that I'm in the studio again with you face to face, I'm not so sure I prefer this. I think I prefer seeing you over the screen rather than being with you face to face. I'm not sure I like you that much. No, I'm kidding. No, it's difficult to believe that the show has reached this point. And for me, it reminds me of, or harkens back to, a point I made previously about how the conversations that the show seeks to cultivate and nurture just continue. Those conversations continue to grow organically and evolve. And I think what we're seeing with the arrival of the 100th show is an apex point, I would call it, in the evolution of the conversations that we've been staging on this show. And so, and I think it's appropriate that we're at this point. And I think this is an opportunity to think about, you know, how to shape these conversations moving forward.
And I think, Marcus, what is really fun about the opportunity to do this show, because you all in the audience are going to see as this show unfolds, we're going to talk about some of those past shows, right? We're going to kind of revisit them. But we had the opportunity, and many of you have already seen, we had the opportunity to have a conversation with Thomas Calder, who is a writer with the Mountain Express. Thomas reached out to me. Thomas and I have had a relationship for a while. Every now and then, if he has some historical question, he would call to talk to me about that. And so Thomas reached out and he said, look, you guys are getting ready to celebrate the 100th episode of the show. How about sitting down for a conversation? So it's interesting to be in conversation with Thomas because it kind of turned the tables on the two of us. Usually, you know, Marcus, we are interviewing people, but this time Thomas was interviewing us. We have the pleasure of having Thomas in the studio with us today. He's going to join us on this conversation in a little while to talk about, you know, how did that conversation with us go? I actually feel like he got more than he bargained for, but I had a really good time kind of reminiscing about why we started the show, what the purpose was. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But one of the things we got to talk to Thomas about was that the show didn't actually originate initially at Blue Ridge Public Radio. It originated at another low-powered radio station here in Asheville, North Carolina, WRES, with Elder Hayes, the late Elder Hayes, who's no longer with us. And I think, Marcus, if I remember correctly, we did about 45 shows over there.
That's right.
So a lot of shows.
Yeah, so I guess technically we've done far more than 100 shows.
Right.
But yeah, when I think back on our days at WRES, I remember those shows fondly, in part because we were very much getting our sea legs, so to speak, and trying to determine whether or not this nascent project that you and I had kind of imagined together was viable. And I also remember the trepidation that we would experience trying to carry an hour-long show, right, early in the show's life. But, you know, I think I remain grateful to the late Elder Hayes for being willing to give us a shot, to give the show a shot, right? To use WRES as kind of a guinea pig platform for what you and I were imagining as far as this show and the kinds of conversations that it seeks to inaugurate and sort of guide. And so, again, you know, without WRES, without the generosity of Elder Hayes, there would be no Waters and Harvey show, I don't think, as we know it today.
So, yeah. Marcus, I think back over the past and the shows that we've done, and I have to say it's a compelling body of work. For this show, we tried to go through and do some selections of shows that, you know, maybe are our favorites, are shows that we like to pull from. You know, in a minute we'll get into a little bit more of that. Mm-hmm. But it was tough. It's tough when I go back through that whole list, especially the list of the shows that we've done here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. It was tough to kind of make decisions about, okay, which one stands out more than another. But all of the conversations have been just, I think, just rich and rewarding. One of the things that has been most rewarding for me in this project is the deepening of our relationship with each other. You and I did not know each other prior to 2013. We both landed here in the city at the same time as professors, and we just developed a relationship. Thought we would kind of take it on the road a little bit because the private conversations, I found them to be compelling. They were deepening, you know, kind of my curiosity about a number of different things that you would bring up and throw into those conversations. And I thought, look, you know, we also need to take the work that we did as professors in the academy and try to speak to a larger audience. There is, I think, I deeply value Marcus, someone who's trained as a pure academic, working in the room, in the classroom with students, working in my field, spending my time talking to my colleagues who are in the field, writing for those colleagues. But there was something that you and I both said was compelling about taking it to a larger audience, to the public, because there's some interesting things that happen in the classroom. There's some interesting things that happen in the so-called ivory tower. So we just said, hey, we're going to take this show on the road and do the work, I guess what you would call it, public intellectuals.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I would say for me, kind of echoing what you just said a moment ago, perhaps the most rewarding aspect of this collaborative project has been the deepening of our friendship and of our relationship as colleagues and as scholars, but also along with that, for me, I've really appreciated the opportunity to one, to recognize the importance of finding ways to translate my own research, what I teach, what I write about, to a broader audience, right? Because it's very easy to lose sight of that importance if one restricts oneself to the walls of the sort of ivory tower. So the importance of recognizing that work, and then two, the importance of cultivating the skills required to do that, right? So it's one thing to recognize, you know, that, hey, it's important that the work that I do, that the work that you do, be translatable beyond our respective guilds. But it's another thing entirely, I think, to figure out how to actually execute that, especially in a context like this, that can be rather unforgiving, in my opinion. So there are multiple levels that through which I've benefited from my work with you, and I look forward to seeing what the future holds.
I do too, Marcus. And I think too that another thing that has been, I think, compelling about this work is not only the deepening of our relationship, which has, but it's also what we've learned not only from each other but from the people that we've been in conversation with. It's added to that notion that conversations matter. We have been working with the William Friday Fellowship for Human Relations for a while with that team. Dr. Meredith Dostra has been a frequent guest on the show, and part of what that whole fellowship has been trying to do is to put people in relationship with each other and making conversations central to that. And sometimes we're not very good at being in conversation, listening, and then engaging conversations with each other. But this kind of doing the show forces you to kind of do that. So you get a chance to know people mm-hmm. more fully. You get a chance to see what is kind of making them think. And then you also mm-hmm. learn a lot from those conversations. So I have been recently kind of tackling a book that was introduced to me by Dr. Doster and the work that we've been doing with the William Brody Fellowship by Sherry Turkle, which is called Reclaiming Conversations, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. It is interesting in this book that she makes the argument that people think that because we're in the digital age, we can communicate through text messages, we communicate through Facebook, we communicate through, all types of other means, emails and those things. Email drives me crazy because it's like it's constantly coming. It's like a hamster wheel. But but what she said, that while we feel that we're more connected to each other, that the research is actually showing that we're not. Mm-hmm. We're less engaged. And in her book, she talks about families that no longer really sit around the dinner table with each other to be in conversations about maybe issues that the family is dealing with, but they are finding it easier easier to kind of text each other, you know, when they're kind of in conversation. Or if there's something they disagree on, I'll do it in text and not face to face. And there's something that you lose through that. And one of the things that Sherry Turkle talks about in this book is that we are not learning to empathize with each other. Mm-hmm. When you have to be in face to face with each other, you really do develop that sense of empathy, I think, which is something that's important for us.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you talk about conversation. In the very last class meeting I had with one of the upper division courses that I taught this past semester, from my department in religious studies, I had a kind of revelation toward the end of the semester that I shared with students about the nature of scholarship itself, right? Which I think in some ways demythologizes scholarship. But basically what I realized is that for all of the technicalities and sophistication that goes, that go into scholarship, at base, scholarship really is a conversation. Mm-hmm. That's really what it is, right? I mean, even at the research level, I mean, when you're seeking out sources, you're engaging sources, you're interacting with sources, you're evaluating sources. That's a kind of conversation, mm-hmm. right? When you reflect in writing on those sources and then create a formal document, that is a kind of conversational exercise, mm-hmm. right? Where you are in relationship with the sources, the scholars that have sort of helped you arrive at whatever your current project mm-hmm. is. And so, I don't know that we ever really get away from conversation as a central trope or practice in human relationship. And, you know, to Turkle's concern here around digital communication, I agree with her, although I can't necessarily pinpoint what it is about text messaging or emailing that seems to corrode our capacity for empathy. But I think she's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, maybe it has to do with the convenience of texting, right? Because as someone who, students who have taken classes with me know this, I'm very candid in talking about how sort of shy I was as a college student, how averse I was to face-to-face contact. any opportunity to be by myself, and be away from crowds or from having to deal face-to-face with anybody, I took it. So I can understand how the convenience of text messaging can kind of be seductive to people who are introverted or to people who are extroverted as well. But beyond that, I'm not really sure what accounts for the negative impact that digital communication seems to have mm-hmm. on empathy. And also, the reality is that, digital communication isn't going anywhere.
All right. It's not.
So the question is, do we reimagine what empathic conversation looks like across digital platforms? Mm-hmm. Or do we kind of pull back a little bit? Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. right, from digital communication in favor of reclaiming, I guess, the old school.
That's a old school.
This
way.
Model, right? The old That's school right. face-to-face model, right? Where you have to deal with people's eyes, their faces, their body language, you know, so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah. Marcus, your last point, I think, is really sticks out in my mind. I think that there's something valuable about being in contact, in face-to-face conversation with each other. There's a lot that's lost in the written word sometimes when you're texting things. But I think, too, here, Marcus, that we've not only been in conversation with each other and with the guests that we've had on the show in these face-to-face conversations, we've been in conversation with the audience as well. And it's been great to get your feedback, to hear from you. We get emails. I know recently you got a pretty lengthy email, Marcus, from someone about something that you had addressed in one of the shows that we did. I've gotten numerous emails from people from time to time when I was still here, living here in Asheville. You know, I've taken on this new role, which moved me back to Raleigh, new role as Deputy Secretary for mm-hmm. Archives and History. But I run into people here, you know, walking through town, and then they would want to talk and have a conversation about something that had occurred or that had emerged in those conversations that we've had. So it's been great for Marcus and I to be in conversation with you all, too. As you all know, I'm a quoter. We started this show out with a quote from Nelson Mandela, who's one of my favorite political figures in the last century. I think someone who moved his country, moved all of us in remarkable ways. But I've often quoted Edmund Burke as well. And this is kind of a paraphrase of Burke's quote, which is that the world belongs to the living, the dead, and those yet to come, that we're all participate in this great historical continuity. Mm-hmm. So we're in conversation with each other. And Marcus, when I think about that quote and knowing that Thomas is going to join us here in a few minutes in this conversation, you know, when he called and he reached out to me about sitting down and maybe having a conversation with you and I for the interview for the Mountain Express, he did say to me, and you all in the audience know that I've become this kind of big, you know, student of Alexis de Tocqueville. And so Thomas said to me, if Alexis de Tocqueville's name does not come up in this interview, I'm going to be disappointed. So I tried not to disappoint him with that. So I'm going to bring up Tocqueville here, you know. And Tocqueville, I think, you know, there's a kind of a natural, in my opinion, as I look at writers like Edmund Burke and then later on Alexis de Tocqueville, there's this kind of natural kind of continuity between these writers. But one of his criticisms of us was that we were not necessarily given in this country, in this new American democracy, given to having a deep knowledge of the past. I'd like to think that as you read Democracy in America and what Tocqueville had to say, that he was imagining that as America grew older, that that would change. And I think we're in a moment right now as we get ready for the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution to begin to think about the past and what were the founding ideals. And we'll bring up Mitch Landrieu, who addressed that at one point in one show that we did with him. But as we kind of move on here, I'd like to bring Thomas on in. Thomas Calder, writer for The Mountain Express, also an author, and I told him just before we got started today that I'm a bit jealous of the fact that he has already published a book. I've not gotten mine done yet, but his book, which is fiction, a novel, The Wind Under the Door, some of you may have seen this, is out. And when we come back from break, we're going to bring Thomas into the show. So stay with us in just a minute. So welcome back. This is the Waters and Hari Show. We're here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I are kind of in conversation with each other talking about this being the 100th episode of the Waters and Hari Show, which is kind of a celebratory moment for us and for many of you, because we've heard from some of you. But we also have as our guest Thomas Calder, writer for The Mountain Express, author of The Wind Under the Door. And the reason why I wanted to bring Marcus, not Thomas, into this conversation today was because Marcus and I had the opportunity to sit for an interview with Thomas for the Mountain Express in preparation for this event, you know, the coming 100th show. And it was a great conversation. So, Thomas, thank you for joining us here. It's good to have you here. Say hello to
everybody. It's great to be here. Thank you very much. It's an honor. I got to say, it's kind of surreal. I'm usually not in air conditioning when I hear you guys. You're in my ear as I'm like doing yard work. So the whole time I've been listening, I'm like, I should be weeding right now. I'm digging out some grass for the garden. So yeah, it's a pleasure. It's an honor. I'm excited to be here.
Well,
yeah.
We're so glad to have you here. I know Marcus and I both are thrilled. And we just have to go back and just think about it. We had a great time with you before we kind of get into talking about unpacking some of the things that we discussed in the conversation we had with you. You know, we Marcus and I kind of put out a question to all of you in preparation for the show about what was the meaning of the show? What was the meaning of the show to you? What meaning does it have to you? How has it impacted your thinking? And we were grateful to get some comments from a few people. One person has been a guest on the show, Chris Cooper, Dr. Chris Cooper, out at Western Carolina University. It's always great to have Chris on the show. I mean, he's a great conversationalist, great storyteller. And Thomas, not Thomas, but Chris wrote in, he sent us an email and in response to those questions, what has the show meant to you? He wrote, the Waters and Harvey Show has meant an opportunity to think about people over politics. What's just beneath the surface, underneath the surface, instead of what is obvious and what can be instead of what is. Marcus, I really did appreciate that comment coming in from Chris. And Thomas, your thoughts when you hear, because you know Chris as well,
yes.
And when you hear that, I got a sense when Marcus and I were in conversation with you that you shared that sentiment that kind of Chris expressed.
Yeah, what I also appreciate about the show is like, and you guys were talking about communication and the online, digital, and the art of conversation and sustained conversation versus I think so many people are accustomed to cable news and just talking about something for 10 minute and a half for a little moment on television and then the issue goes away. What I appreciate about your show is you guys keep coming back to certain issues, certain topics, and you really want to explore it. And you're obviously allowing yourselves, as well as your guests, as well as your audience, to think on things for an extended period of time and kind of to examine it from all different angles and get that nuance that, as a student of history, as someone with background in literature, I just appreciate that ability to continue to have those conversations and not just drop them and move on to the next topic. That may or may not be of great significance.
Yeah, and something I'm reminded of, Thomas, that both Darren and I live with, I think as scholars, is that we tend to be interested in issues that haunt us, right? So in other words, you know, we make a choice to live with ghosts all the time, and I think that's one way of explaining why these issues sort of tend to reemerge on the show from different vectors, right? From different vantage points. And that leads me to wonder, Chris, can you say a bit more about what motivated your interest in wanting to write a piece on our show? Darren mentioned that we did an interview with you recently, which I think was a lot of fun. I was able to finally be honest about what I think about you. I'm joking, but yeah, Thomas. So any thoughts about what led you to say, let me write about this show?
Well, part of it is I'm a fan of the show. And I've been kind of hounding Darren for the last like 5 years at least for various things. So as I was listening to the show, doing my yard work, you know, you guys would keep mentioning that the 100th was coming up and it seemed like a big deal, a celebration. And I wanted to get a chance really just to have my own private Waters and Harvey show experience.
But I think it turned out to be more than you bargained for.
I loved every minute of it. I really had a great time. And that was truly, I wanted to be part of, you know, bring other people in who might not be listening to the show, who may read Mountain Express. I do think the paper also, our mission kind of runs parallel and overlaps with a lot of what you guys are doing as far as just
encouraging community conversation, ongoing conversation, and looking at things, not just dropping picking it up and dropping it, but really exploring it. And I think the haunting and self-reflection are two things that come up a lot in the show. Mm-hmm. And those are two topics that as a writer, as a fiction writer in particular, but also as a fan of history, just those are two issues that I think are really important and really interesting. Right. So I wanted to talk more to you guys about
that. Well, I can echo Marcus and say, Thomas, we deeply enjoyed the conversation. And what's interesting for you all in the audience is, and we are continue to say we're so grateful to have so many of you who are faithful listeners to the show, kind of like Thomas, is that, we come into the studio, we can call our home offices our studio, right? Mm-hmm. We come in with an outline of what the show is going to be, but it quickly goes out the door because conversations really are supposed to unfold naturally anyway. But Marcus and I keep the show outline in front of us just as a guide, and then Marcus has this this recurring fear of dead air. Right. So, you know, if he thinks that the air is about to go dead, he kicks me in the shin, you know, so there's this back and forth. But the outline helps us. And even now, as I'm looking at the outline, I'm looking at the things that we have, and we pack a lot in here. And I think academics have a tendency to do that. It's kind of overkill. We have more than we actually have time to actually cover. But one of the things that we want to talk with you about is some of your favorite shows. But before we do that, I'm thinking about the conversations, the territory that we've covered. We've covered a lot of territory in these 100 shows. Marcus, I was thinking about the show that we did exploring Native American history. Mm-hmm. And we did that with Dr. Trey Adcock. We had the State of Black Asheville talking about what was going on here in the community of Asheville with Dr. Dwight Mullen, who's now retired from the university. And I know he stays very active in the community here. But he even grew that project to look at the state of Black North Carolina. And one year when we did the African Americans in Western North Carolina conference, he brought in scholars from down in Greensboro and Winston-Salem, from some of North Carolina's great historically Black colleges and universities, to kind of engage in a conversation about African American life across the state. I'm now getting a chance to kind of see that with a bird's eye view, traveling across our great state, looking at what is going on, not only in African American communities, but community in general. I also think about the conversation that we had with Diane Tower Jones and Sekou Coleman early on, Marcus, Beneath the Veneer, and looking at what's mm-hmm. going on underneath the surface, especially here in Asheville, mm-hmm. where their focus was. So there have been a lot of conversations that we've had, great conversations with David Blight, with Commissioner, Buncombe County Commissioner here, Alfred Whitesides, who was a trailblazer in this community, as was Attorney James Ferguson, mm-hmm. one of the leading civil rights attorneys in the state. So in the country, but we've had all of these kind of far-reaching conversations. But that gives me a chance to, Thomas gives both Marcus and I a chance to ask you, what are some of the favorite shows as you think about, you go through the recesses of your mind, what stands out to you?
Before I get to that, I did want to offer listeners and those who've read the article that I wrote about the 100th episode, which at the time, obviously, I did not know I would be part of. You were mentioning just you pack a lot in. And I was looking back over our transcript, and we had a transcript of 11,046 words, and the article itself was 1,168 words. Oh. So a significant amount of the conversation couldn't get into the article, obviously, due to the space limitations. But I feel like I got a lot of the heart of the conversation mm-hmm. in there. But there is a topic I'd like to speak more to you guys about at some point mm-hmm. during today's show. But going back to your question about favorite shows, I was listening again last night before my Miami Heat got just beat up by the 76ers to William Turner, the conversation you had. And I thought your introduction was incredibly powerful, just asking why, kind of the shame of why George Floyd in this moment is the awakening for many. And you brought it back to lynching and the history and the fact and the gruesome history, obviously, of the dismemberment and the fact that these were events that were promoted at churches and large numbers of white people would come to watch. I thought that introduction was super powerful. And then I've had the opportunity and privilege of interviewing Dr. Turner for an article I wrote years ago. He did a talk at UNCA that you were part of. And he's just got so much energy and so much knowledge, obviously. So it was good to revisit and hear him. The talk he gave at UNC was just like bouncing off the walls. Like he's, and we connected, he and I, because we both, he's in Houston. I was living in Houston at one point. The David Blight conversation I revisited actually before I interviewed you guys for the article. Just to revisit that, that was the 30-minute segment, and I got to hear him speak at Lenore Ryan years ago, so that was a treasure. And then just, you know, locals, the Steve Nashes, Kimberly Floyd, and then the larger conversations that you've had with multiple community members about reparations, about Vance Monument. It's just, you know, as a person who loves local history in particular, but history in general, it's just a beautiful show.
Kind of runs the gamut.
We've covered a lot of territory.
And Dr. Turner. Yeah. Dr. Turner. He's a showman, too.
He's a showman.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And those of you who have not had the opportunity to hear him speak in person, you know, if you get the chance, you should. Yeah. Just like David Blight. David Blight is a showman as well, and just a great storyteller.
Different kind of showman, but still a showman.
It is. Oh, yeah.
Definitely, yeah. And, you know, thinking about shows we've done in the past, I think also about the show with former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu. And, in fact, we're going to pause for a moment to remind our listeners of some of the important points that that Mitch had to say. So we'll pause for a moment here.
Mm-hmm. You know, I stand on the shoulders of a lot of people. I'm 60 years old now. My wife and I have 5 children. I can't really remember anything in my life that I did on my own. I can't think of a thought that I had that somebody else didn't contribute to, or that or people who went before me whose shoulders I stood on. My dad served as a state legislator, as a mayor, and secretary of Jimmy Carter's cabinet. My sister Mary was a United States senator. My sister Madeline was a judge. Between the three of us and others, we have 110 years of elected service to the country. And it's been a blessing. I mean, it really has been an incredible opportunity because it forces you to get outside of yourself and to see other people and to hear other people. And your life gets enriched by the connection that you have to all the incredible people that you can meet.
You know, Marcus, I'm glad we played that clip. And, you know, I mentioned, I think, before that, you know, and it may have been on another occasion that even Martin Luther King himself, you know, was a great historian. You know, he thought about the people who had come before him and then we stood on these shoulders. I quoted Burke early on. And that clip that that we had selected from that conversation with Mitch, I think, was a rich one because he talks about the shoulders that we kind of stand upon and understanding the richness of the American past. And so I don't know what else. And Thomas, if there's a comment you want to make about what you heard Mitch saying there. And Mitch, that show actually turned into the Mitch Landrieu show. Right? He really took that one over.
I just think something you guys talk about a lot on the show is just mythology and the American mythology. And he's touching there on just like the self-made versus the standing on the shoulders of others. And I'm just fascinated by that conversation in particular that you guys have a lot, because I do think that the mythology of the self-made just leads to so much toxicity and It's a thing that is then used to excuse poor behavior and terrible behavior, and that's a topic that I think is so important to continue to discuss. And you see how it gets just warped, where you can be someone who inherits $1 million and still say you're a self-made person or a loan of $1 million.
And this idea of being self-made, I think it's just so important to recognize this, because, you know, thinking about American mythologies, Thomas, it seems to me that this myth of really anyone being self-made is really at the heart of the American mythos, right? The idea that this is even a phenomenon. And you know, I think part of what Mitch is helping us to see is that is probably never the case, right? I mean, as much as we might want to think it is, it's never the case. I mean, there were cases during the period of slavery in the United States where white slave owners whose wealth had been built upon, you know, the backs of slaves, were running around calling themselves self-made men,
when their bodies themselves had done nothing to produce the wealth that they now enjoyed as a result of labor produced by other bodies. And so, yeah, so what does it mean? What would it mean for the country to reimagine itself in a way that doesn't center this trope of being self-made? And I think that would be a risky endeavor, because it seems to me that this myth of American exceptionalism mm-hmm. is very much tethered to this idea of being self-made. But if that idea goes away,
right.
is America exceptional anymore?
Right.
right? Right. So anyway, this is a very important point to, I think, reflect on.
It really is. And, you know, Marcus, for a while, you know, I've been reading. One of my favorite writers is George Packer, who writes mm-hmm. for the Atlantic magazine. He's written a number of books. Just a brilliant writer. And Packer's last book, which was entitled The Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal, kind of, with me, connects with that show that we did with Mitch Landrieu. Because in that body of shows, we had been asking, you and I had been asking a series of questions that were resonating with a lot of people who listened to the show, with many members of the audience. Those two questions they became three questions. Question mm-hmm. was, who are we and who do we wish to be? And Marcus, you threw another question in there mm-hmm. in the mix, which was, is there a we? And we think about the American Constitution. It begins with these words, we the people. You know, so when are we? And this is a question I think that will be recurring and will be coming back to, not only on this show, but I'm hoping that we'll be thinking about it at least as North Carolinians and hopefully as Americans, as we think about the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution and the ideals that actually founded the country. So Mitch actually said, you know, this is the only country that was founded on an ideal, right? So he made that comment in that show. But there was another quote that I think, another piece or segment of that show that really connects with those questions that you and I had been asking. And so we want to play that one too, if we can, because, you know, he was taking on some major challenges in New Orleans when he was there. Mm-hmm. So if we can bring up that other segment from that show with Mitch.
I said, we cannot do this anymore, not in my city and not anywhere in the country. And we are going to lean forward and stand on the shoulders of the community that had been asking us. And we're going to ask people to face this question and we're going to make them answer it. And if we get it right, we should take them down, because it doesn't reflect who we are as a people. It didn't reflect our history. It was a historical lie. It was the wrong thing to revere, and it was incomprehensible to me. And Malia, I'm glad you're on the phone, because in the speech that I gave about it, it actually references a true story that a mother told me about trying to explain it to her daughter. And so there's a part in the speech that I give saying, look at it from my perspective. I turned that perspective into the perspective of a 12-year-old African-American female looking up at Robert E. Lee. And I asked the question, when she looks at him, do you think she thinks her future is bright? Mm-hmm. Do you think that she thinks Robert E. Lee is there to lift her up or to push her down? Mm-hmm. So if we're asking ourselves, where is the future? And we're asking ourselves, what are we doing to encourage the young people to rise into their responsibility and their beauty and everything that they have? Do you think that's a plus or a minus? And if that's true, that he's pushing her down, what's the city of New Orleans going to look like in 2030 or 2040? No major company in America is going to want to come hang out in a southern town that reveres the Confederacy. And this is absolutely true. So if you don't care about this as a matter of justice, you better start caring about it as a matter of economic possibility, because no company in America who needs a diverse workforce is going to want to be hanging out in any town that has the tint or hint that white supremacy is anything other than a memory never to be repeated.
Well, you're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I'll be right back in a moment. You're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I are in conversation with Thomas Calder. You've been listening to some clips from past shows that we've done, because we're celebrating the 100th episode of the Waters and Harvey Show, which this show is. And so you just heard, Marcus, the audience just had a chance, and we had a chance to listen to it here in the studio as well. Another clip from that show with Mitch Landrieu, which was one of my favorite shows. Mm-hmm. It was a deep, rich show. And obviously, he was dealing with the issue of Confederacy. Confederate monuments in the city of New Orleans. And so he was talking about how they were engaging it. And it really, to me, that resonated around those questions that you and I had been asking about, who are we and who do we wish to be? And I feel like Mitch was kind of pulling those up. In fact, at one point in that show, he did raise those questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he made a point about the monument, saying that essentially arguing that they should be taken down because they don't really reflect who we are, right? Here, this idea of we is rearing its head again. But it makes me wonder, was there not a way in which those monuments did very much reflect the we sort of constructed within the dominant American imaginary? I mean, I think they were very much reflective of the principal artificers of the American story, which was an exclusive group, right? Restricted to, you know, going back, you know, to the 19th century before the Civil War, the sort of, you know, white landed gentry, right? The educated, so on and so forth. So I think with those Confederate monuments and those kind of sort of monuments to America's slaveocracy, I think what those monuments do reflect is a very particular we. It's not that they don't reflect who we are. They do kind of reflect what America has been and kind of still what America is, in a sense. The question is, what to do with that older we.
Right.
Right. Is it possible to reimagine that in a way that dislodges or decenters or displaces that older we? That to me is the question.
Yeah.
Right. I think we have to be honest when we in thinking about the important historical and social role played by those monuments vis-a-vis how America imagined itself. Because to me, the two are, you know, they're very, absolutely very different. Integrally related, I think. And so that to me is a hard truth that Mitch's comments, for me, sort of indirectly push us to deal with.
All right. And Thomas, I want to give you an opportunity to share your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I'm just listening and thinking about, right, from like 1890 to 1950, who were we in that time period when these monuments were going up? And what was the story that we, in this case, the white citizens, what were we telling ourselves, and what were the stories that we were promoting, and how were we reimagining those stories when it comes to the Confederacy in particular? But you could see that in the present day as well, and you could see it at the lightning speed in which narratives start to turn and take on a new story. I'm thinking specifically of like January 6th, like how those narratives start one way and then they morph within a couple of weeks, months, you know. So you can imagine then the same thing going on for an extended period with a much more collective backing behind them as far as getting those stories in the books and reading through the ways that the Civil War was taught afterwards to students, and the questions. And one that sticks out in particular was about the Ku Klux Klan and what they were, you know, formed for, and it was to protect the white citizens. So you're just looking at that stuff and thinking about how narrative influences and changes the way groups create conversations.
Right. You are both making very key points here. And, you know, one of the things is with this show too, Marcus, I want to point out that you and I have always been amazed by is how quickly the time flies, right? It goes really fast. There's so much that we want to do in this particular show. We were reminiscing about some other shows that we had done. Early on, we did a show with Johnny Davis, former NBA basketball star, drafted to the Portland Trail Blazers in the 1970s. He had one of the longest careers with the NBA, both as a player and then as a coach, 38 years with the NBA in different roles. He and his wife retired to Asheville, right? Both of you and I had the opportunity to develop a relationship with Johnny. And Johnny is this one of these people who's very focused on community development and opportunities. And that was a rich conversation. And we encourage you to go back and actually listen to some of the things that came out of that show that he talked about. And especially, I think, that are important as children, or as the youth, our younger people think about what their futures will be. He's like, we need to broaden our our idea of what is possible as a profession, as we think about what is possible as we. I also, Marcus, want to take the time to think about the conversation that you and I had with Audrey and Frank Peterman, who are big advocates for the National Park System. Two people who had intended to retire to Belize when they retired, and then decided, nope, they were going to come back to the United States after they were asked a question in Belize about what is the United States really like, and especially the national parks. And they had never toured the national parks, so they decided to buy an RV and tour all of the national parks. Marcus, what stood out to me in that conversation with them, and I'll point out here that their work was actually rewarded and actually acknowledged by President Obama when he was in office. But one of the things that she said, they both talked about how diverse we are becoming, and the demographics of the country are shifting. We're becoming much more diverse, and how we need to kind of broaden who the we is to give people ownership and a stake in the future of the country. And she was talking about the national park system, thinking that we support our national parks. And I think about the state park system here in North Carolina. We will support these parks, these important spaces, through the tax dollars of the American public. So if we want people to feel that they have a stake, we have to do that now. We need to change the narratives that we're telling about who we are, right? So that was one of those rich conversations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I'm just thinking about, you know, a thing that we've wrestled with on this show over and over again, which is the importance of story. When I think about the story that has been deployed in order to establish a sense of American identity, largely along white lines, as Thomas suggested earlier. When I think about that, I also think about the ways in which that story has reconfigured itself in an effort to essentially preserve itself, mm-hmm. right? So there's a way in which sort of new stories that are still connected to the old story, right, are sort of sent out to do particular kinds of work, right, to protect against the intrusion of new stories that might not be, that aren't really, or that might challenge that original sort of mythological narrative. And so I think we have to also deal with the fact that the introduction of new stories or the writing of new stories will involve conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a peaceful kumbaya kind of process. I mean, it is a kind of I will stop short of saying warfare, but it is a kind of tensive, conflictual process that I think, you know, we have to be courageous about dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about that in response to Thomas's remarks a few moments ago.
Well, yeah. Marcus, you know, time is flying on us, and we don't want to end this show without talking about one of our, at least, you know, you are an expert on jazz, right?
We have talked
about jazz on the show a lot, and when we did that conversation, we had that conversation with Thomas, you know, he was asking us about our mission, and remember your former advisor, dissertation advisor, Diane's remind her.
Diane Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Diane, we had her on the show a couple of times when we were at WRES and then here at Blue Ridge Public Radio. And when we did the show and she was in the studio with us, she did say, it's like watching jazz.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of watching you guys kind of go back and mm-hmm. forth. And so Thomas did ask us, you know, he asked a question that gave me an opportunity to kind of talk about that and say that what we try to do with this show is, and this is a quote from his story, we try to bring a little soul and a little blues and jazz to the conversation. And a couple of my favorite writers, you know, Stanley Crouch, who died last year, Stanley Crouch, a social critic, wrote about jazz and blues in America, these two traditional art original art forms. Albert Murray has written about the blues, and he makes a statement in one of his books, I think, The Omni-Americans, that we use the blues to get over the blues. Who's feeling miserable and sad once you've heard a blues song? You know, it's the blues, but you use the blues to get over. So he kind of describes
cathartic and constructive.
Yeah, he describes the founding fathers in the form of government that was constructed to give freedom, but at the same time some distrust in giving too much freedom. He looked at them kind of as blues people. You know, there was a form of blues that you've got to use the blues to get over the blues. We had the opportunity to develop a relationship with the Corps. You know, our theme music for the show, we went through a number of iterations of theme music for the show, used Herbie Hancock for a while.
One of my faves.
But we ended up with, you know, with the Corps. We had a conversation with them on the show when we introduced Leroy, which is the name of the song that we, the piece that we used to open the show. You know, Marcus, anything you want to say about jazz and just the blues before
I would not say that I'm a jazz expert. I don't want our listeners thinking that I'm some authority, but it is a genre that is very close to my heart, and I think it provides a means of making sense of a lot of the complexity that we experience as human beings. I think it's a part of what is unique about this genre is that even though it is very much, I think, birthed within the cauldron of the African-American artistic tradition in the United States, it is nonetheless an art form that I think transcends racial lines, gender lines, class lines, social lines, cultural lines, in its ability to communicate, to touch, to transform, to create. And so for those reasons, jazz is really, really special to me. And I think that Diane is correct. There is something about the way that we communicate that, for me, is reminiscent of the process of creating a jazz composition, right? Every aspect is not mapped out, right? You don't always know how things are going to go from moment to moment. I mean, you have a basic idea, but you have to exercise the courage to sort of let the process unfold and trust that you can follow the process.
Right.
And you and I think have that kind of dynamic, and so. I also think that jazz is important for understanding the practice of conversation, right? I think that there's something fundamentally there's something very similar between the work of trying to build a relationship with other people and the kind of creative process that goes into making a jazz composition. And so I think as our listeners think about, well, what do they mean by conversation? What does it mean to practice conversation? What does it mean to practice relationship? Listen to jazz music.
Right.
Right. Listen to Herbie Hancock. Listen to the Corps. And you'll begin, you know, the more you hear it, the more you sort of understand that there's a connection between how these different instruments talk to each other and how, you know, the complexity, the evolution involved in that. There's a connection between that and the complexities involved in building human-to-human relationship. And so, you know, I just can't say it enough about jazz along that line.
So when I think about the show, I think about the state of North Carolina, I think about this country, jazz comes to mind. You know, different people doing different things, but you find some harmony and rhythm in there somehow. But trust, as you said, is key to that. You got to trust one another to perform. And I think what's interesting about jazz, Marcus, is that never the performance of in any one piece is never the same. I mean, it's always something different that's being done, but it comes out so magically beautiful. I think also here, thinking about Stanley Crouch, another term that he used to describe America is gumbo, thinking about Mitch, the great American gumbo. You know, you put all of these things together, but it produces something that is very tasty, you know. So as we think about America, I think this is a good way for us to kind of maybe think about about our future as jazz or as blues, as we're thinking about who it is we are and who we want to be, one of the things that Marcus and I want to do, and Thomas, we want to thank you again for being with us just to celebrate this 100th show. This has been fun. I know we've kind of gone the gamut. I mean, we haven't even covered a drop of the shows that we've done, Marcus, and maybe we can continue to talk about others as we do more shows, because we will continue this process for as long as we can. We've had so much fun doing it, but we wanted to give an opportunity to play a little bit more of the music this time. You don't get a chance to hear it of the theme music. But before we do that, Marcus, and I want to thank you all in the audience for continuing to engage with us, continuing to listen, and we're going to look forward to being in continued conversation with you all as we kind of move forward. We want to hear from you as well. And before we do go out, I just want to, Marcus and I want to remember to remind you once again that the Watterson Harvey Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, in partnership with the Institute for Promotion of Human Understanding.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, the BPR and NPR One mobile apps, and on Apple Podcasts and Google Play.
And you can follow us and get in touch on Facebook as you do, and follow us on Twitter, or write us at WHShow@BPR.org. And before we go and the music comes on, we want to thank Matt Bush for being a part of this project, the whole team here at Blue Ridge Public Radio, but Matt in particular, he's done a wonderful job in putting these shows together. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.